I'll bet you have this one.
Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the Education Finance Committee to order. First thing is I'd like to make an announcement. We have a new member of the Education Finance team who's joining us today. Jody Withers is the new committee administrator for the Education Finance Committee. For those that don't know, Aaron Solom, the previous committee administrator, just couldn't take the burden of this committee and the snarkiness of all its members. And no, he had other opportunities. He moved on to. We miss Aaron, but very, very glad to have Jody join the Education Finance Committee. Do you just want to take a couple seconds to tell the committee about yourself, and if you could be an animal, what animal you would be and why?
Well, I'll pass on the animal question, but I'm formerly with the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee, and I'm happy to be with the Education Finance Committee, and thank you very much.
Thank you. That was brief. That was good.
So, may he be a role model for the rest?
Yes, there you go. So,
especially the animal part.
We'll call this committee back into order. And we have one item on the agenda today, and that is Minnesota's application for a waiver from the No Child Left Behind program. We have Commissioner Brenda Casilius with us, as well as members of the Department of Education and some legislative and fiscal analysts.
For our, do we want to have staff do a run-through first? Is that what we're starting off with? Or do you want to start with the
question? Commissioner, do you prefer to testify first, or is it okay if we have staff do a run-through? Do you have a preference? Sure. So we'll start off by taking testimony from the commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. I'm Brenda Casilius, Commissioner of Education. Are you ready, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we are. Thanks.
Mr. Chair and members, I want to thank you for the opportunity to join you today. I am delighted to be able to share additional information with you about Minnesota's No Child Left Behind waiver request. The entire Minnesota Department of Education appreciates the opportunity to share this information on this very important issue and with the public who have so much at stake in the success of our students and our schools. With me today is Minnesota Department of Education's Deputy Commissioner Jesse Montano and our federal liaison Sam Kramer, who's right behind us. After I provide an overview of the waiver request, Ms. Montano will speak to the process of developing the waiver request, and Mr. Kramer will address the particulars of Minnesota's request. ESEA, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, otherwise known as No Child Left Behind, is 4 years overdue for reauthorization. President Obama and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan have been urging Congress to reauthorize the law. To be clear, Secretary Duncan has often said reauthorization is far preferable method to strengthen and improve the law than is a waiver process for states. And he continues to state reauthorization is and always has been Plan A. Currently, ESEA reauthorization is moving forward in the Senate. However, there is still quite a way to go before the full Senate votes on the bill. There is equal distance and challenge ahead before the House would vote on its own reauthorization bill or concur with the Senate's version. And so our schools wait as legislation languishes. Within a few short years, nearly all Minnesota schools, many of which are making a real difference for students, will be labeled as failures, and hundreds of more local schools will be subject to a system of federal interventions that data has shown to be ineffective. That is why the administration has proposed a waiver alternative, and that is why Minnesota is seeking relief from the failed measures of school accountability and interventions mandated by the federal government. Minnesota is not alone in seeking this relief. 39 states, Puerto Rico, and D.C. have said they will seek the waiver this year, and many others have said they will do so next year if ESEA is not reauthorized. Again, I want to be clear about our position. Minnesota is not seeking a pass on accountability, nor is the USDOE taking the waiver process lightly. What we are seeking is meaningful accountability that gives us a true picture of how our schools are serving every student. The waiver guidelines require four principles and state that we must meet these principles to ensure firm plans for accountability are met. First, states must have college and career ready standards. Second, states must have or be in the development of teacher and principal evaluation. Third, states must have a plan for assessment and accountability. And fourth, states must actively seek reduction of burdensome paperwork and duplication. The US DOE has set a high bar for approval. All applications will be peer-reviewed. Minnesota is not guaranteed approval. But since we have the principles required for ESEA flexibility, and those have already been enacted by this legislature and legislatures in the past, many with bipartisan support from members of this body, Minnesota is well positioned to take advantage of this opportunity. Minnesota has consistently increased the rigor of its standards by aligning them to college and career-ready expectations. Our standards were crafted with higher education partners and have been nationally peer-reviewed and certified as college and career-ready. Minnesota is a nationally recognized leader in the pursuit of high standards, and our MDE content experts were most recently selected to join other states in the creation of next-generation science standards. Our math standards are equally high, as evidenced in our being in the top three states for our NAEP math achievement just released yesterday. We have just adopted the ELA Common Core, and therefore will not see the results until those are fully implemented, but given our stagnant reading scores, I am eager to begin implementation of our new ELA standards, and those too are college and career ready aligned. Minnesota's accountability system already has many of the features required by the waiver. Our school improvement grant, also known as a SIG grant, already identifies some of the most persistently low-achieving schools and works with them to implement turnaround models similar to the principles outlined in the federal guidance. There are several other decisions that will have to be made about how to provide differentiated recognition, accountability, and support to schools, but the state already has made policies and tools and put tools in place that will make this possible. Thanks to bipartisan legislation passed this last session, Minnesota's recently adopted teacher and principal evaluation policy is aligned with the waiver requirements for supporting effective instruction and leadership. Just this week, Minnesota was recognized by the National Council for Teacher Quality for its new law, along with 16 other states. Finally, as part of the governor's push for a more efficient and effective government, the Minnesota Department of Education is working to reduce burdensome reporting requirements for districts and will be better positioned to offer further assistance in this area if granted greater flexibility from federal reporting requirements. This would also assist the agency as we move from becoming an agency of greater strategic support and assistance to schools. Under the waiver guidelines, states must identify the 5% of Title I schools that are the most persistently low-achieving as priority schools and implement rigorous reforms and reform models in those schools. Although our overall achievement is above average among states, our non-white and poor student achievement disparity is among the worst in the nation. This is not how Minnesota will stay competitive, especially as our demographics shift and more students are born into poverty conditions. Currently, about 15 to 20% of Minnesota babies are born into poverty. When we look closer, the disparity is greater. 60% of American Indian babies are born into poverty, 42% African American, 33% Hispanic, 10% Asian, and 8% white. Being born into these circumstances can limit a child's opportunity and access to appropriate health care and education. We also know that from birth to age 5 is critical to a child's development, and investing earlier can be a game changer for a child born into poverty. I know this to be true. It made a difference for me, and every child should have the opportunity for a hand up out of poverty and be positioned for success. Given the 20-year stagnation of our achievement gaps and our inability to move forward in this area, Minnesota must be more strategic and focused in our efforts to address achievement disparities head-on and support our schools in their efforts to eliminate these disparities. Fortunately, Minnesota is not alone in recognizing this urgency. The US DOE has also recognized it and is requiring waiver applicants to identify the 10% of Title I schools that either have low graduation rates, low-performing subgroups, or the widest achievement gaps. They are calling these schools focus schools, and the state agency must work with districts to improve the performance of these schools. This new designation will allow us to provide strategic support so we can begin to close these persistent and nagging gaps more rapidly and effectively. States must also identify an unspecified percentage Title I schools as reward schools based on high levels of achievement or high levels of academic growth. This is exciting. Instead of solely a punitive approach, we will recognize excellence. This concept is very similar to the high-performance awards proposed by the governor last legislative session. We believe we should learn and celebrate the great work of teachers and schools throughout Minnesota, and that these schools should be celebrated, rewarded, and we should all learn from them. We can no longer work in silos if we want rapid transformation, and we want transformation that is sustained. Change that sticks is change that is shared. Finally, states must continue to provide incentives and support for Title I schools that do not fall into any of these three designated categories. We will continue to measure these schools and report out their progress, and will continue to support and encourage ways to network these schools into teams so that they can better support one another, and we can continue to build our collective capacity throughout Minnesota. Minnesota already has a growth model and statute that offers a more complete way to measure how well a school is doing. Based on growth, rather than using just one measure that scores one group of kids to a totally different group of kids the next year. Currently, more than 70% of our school districts across the state are labeled as not making AYP. But I ask, with our children leading the nation in NAEP math scores and posting ACT scores that are year after year among the country's highest, how is it that so many of our schools and districts can be labeled as failures? The only way is by a misguided measure and mandated by a failed law. Mr. Chair and members, we all agree that we still have significant work to do in our schools, not the least of which is working to ensure every student, every unique learner, and every school every day is getting their educational needs met. But let's not paint all schools as failures because of our own failure to measure them fairly and accurately when we have a chance to do it better. Let's get this piece right so we can move forward to work with those schools that have multiple years of evidence that they need significant support. Let's also begin to reward and celebrate the schools we know are doing well, and let's highlight their success and learn from them. Let's continue our successful tradition of supporting greater local control with accountability for results. And let's make the most of our resources in tough economic times by making strategically focused and intentional decisions about the support we give our teachers and our schools. The window of opportunity is open for Minnesota to take responsibility for its educational system, to be accountable for delivering on our constitutional promise of a uniform system of public schools for all of Minnesota's children. Let's make the most of this opportunity to make state and local decisions that work best for Minnesota students and Minnesota schools. Again, thank you for this opportunity. I'll now turn things over to Deputy Montano to cover the process for requesting the waiver, and Sam Kramer to speak in greater detail about the particulars of our request. Thank you so much for this opportunity today.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Any questions from members of the committee for the commissioner? Just a couple of questions I have. Commissioner, just regarding the what do you envision will be the statutory modifications necessary for a waiver request? Do you have any insight on that?
Well, we've looked really closely at the statutory requirements, and many of those requirements have already been made by this body or other bodies. And Sam Kramer, who's our federal liaison, has been looking at that very closely with our government relations folks, and they can answer that question in more detail moving forward.
Okay.
But we don't believe that there are any for this waiver request. If we did additional accountability measures in the future as a state, we may require some legislation for that, but not in this waiver request.
So for this waiver request, you don't, it's your belief that there's no legislative action needed?
Right.
In your testimony, you mentioned about interventions, relief from interventions that are ineffective. Do you have any examples of what interventions the federal government is currently imposing on us that, I believe you used the term, the data would say are ineffective?
I'm looking at the interventions that we've done in our constant results with schools. We have more and more schools going into AYP, and so that's evidence that what we're doing is not working. And we want to work in a local control way with our school districts to be able to work alongside them to find those solutions. And those can involve multiple different contextualized approaches and strategies and learning from high-performing schools that I think would be better solutions and investing in the classroom and the teacher. But those should be local decisions, not some mandated box of opportunities that the federal government tells us that we have to do.
specifically, is there anything that's being mandated that you, in your opinion, you would say are not working outside of the AYP designation?
It depends on the situation. So, you know, there's been some conversation about some strategies that aren't working. You know, everyone often disputes class size reduction. They'll often dispute reading programs, or they might dispute certain types of curriculum that might be implemented, or they might dispute SES or choice or other things as ineffective. However, those decisions ought to be made by the local school district on what they think they should do for intervention alongside with the state.
Okay. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if it's best to hold some of these questions, I'm glad to. It sounded like the commissioner was on a tight time frame, and if it's beneficial to get back to some of these after the other testifiers, I will defer and hold off on a couple. But I actually have a few questions. Continuing one from when we met at your offices a month or so ago, the work group, the waiver work group, who is on that, and to what extent has there been legislative interaction? I haven't seen a lot on the process of the work group and some of the more detailed materials, other than the update that we few receive.
Yeah. Representative Downey, thank you so much. And I really do appreciate the joint session that we had at the department for the Senate committee and the House committees to come on October 17th. That was very beneficial, and I appreciated everybody's time and effort to be there. We have, Jesse can speak more to the stakeholder engagement group, but we did invite the chairs of the policy committees on the Senate and the House side, and then all of the representative stakeholder engagement groups. But I think Jesse can give you a more specific answer about that, because she's going to cover that in her testimony.
And Deputy Commissioner Montano, before we get to this, if people have, I know you're on a tight time frame, Commissioner, do you have any questions, Representative Downey, specifically for the Commissioner outside of that?
Mr. Chair, maybe depending on some of the answers.
Okay. Commissioner, do you mind sharing with the committee your time frame? What time do you need to get out of here at?
Well, I should probably get going right after my testimony here pretty soon.
Okay. So with that then, is there any other members of the committee who have questions for the Commissioner? And we'll go to Ms. Montano Representative Depke, and then we'll come back then.
Just real quick, Commissioner Avendano, thank you very much for your testimony. Was there any discussion with the governor that seeking a waiver was the best way to go forward on NCLB?
Real early on, when we had just gotten out of the shutdown, when the secretary first announced the waiver opportunity, the governor had directed me to go for the initial waiver, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions for members of the committee? Then, Ms. Montano, if you could answer Representative Downey's question, and then we'll see if he has a follow-up for the commissioner based on your answer. So good luck with that one.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jesse Montano. I'm Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education. Representative Downing, we invited the chairs, as the commissioner indicated, of the policy committee in both the House and the Senate. Representative Erickson has attended, I believe, all but maybe the first meeting that we had, but we have been posting to our web. We have a special site where we have posted all information, all handouts, summary of every meeting that anybody can access in terms of what has been discussed and the handout and information that has been presented.
Representative Downey.
Staff has also.
And staff have also, from both House and Senate, have attended every single meeting.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And so would you describe their involvement as being one of participation and concurrence with the recommendations that we're seeing here, the legislative representatives?
Deputy Commissioner Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downing, the meetings have been about discussing the various options. I believe the last meeting, which is this Friday, we're going to look at all the options and actually get more firmer feedback from the members of the committee. There are definitely pluses and minuses to the various options and alternatives that we have discussed. We've provided them with data, information, simulations of what happens if you do this, what happens if you do this. I know that the last meeting they asked for further simulations, We're prepared to present those and give them to the members on Friday. And based on that, then really look firmly at the final direction we're going to take.
Representative Downey?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just an observation, and I don't think we're going to plow through all of this here today. But, you know, clearly this is a big deal. And I know many of us, myself included, are not big fans of the way AYP is measured and this kind of mythical 100% by 2014 metric. And yet, if you look at some of the data and the tables that were provided, the overall construct of No Child Left Behind and the mechanics of the testing and the implementation of the standards and things, granted plenty of opportunities for improvement. I mean, our scores have been trending upward, and so I personally get very nervous when it feels to me like over in the Department of Education, without a lot of thorough vetting here through the legislative process, that we're talking about a really fundamental rewrite. Some of the terminology that I see seems pretty squishy compared to the old NCLB terminology. I don't even really know fully what all of that means, and I appreciate that we have two representatives from the legislature on their working group. But while that's very different than a really robust and comprehensive debate of the issues and the merits of some of these approaches at the legislature. So as I mentioned in our little side meeting a couple of weeks ago, I'm really fearful that we're going to walk into the legislative session next year feeling like we need to rewrite or rethink a lot of what the administration is, from what I can tell, fairly unilaterally implementing. So I just raise that as a concern and an ongoing concern that we're going to have a lot of work to do next year, and we're going to be left with undoing the fix or fixing the fix as compared to really collaborating on it on the front end. And that's, I think, a big concern when we're talking about something this important and this big.
Representative Greiling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, I just, as I was thinking about coming to this meeting, I was thinking about how this is the mirror image of legislative hearings we had when I was the chair with Governor Pawlenty and Commissioner Segrin when they were applying for race to the top. We had the very same process as far as, you know, the work groups and legislators being there and so forth. But in the end, and then we had a hearing like this, you know, where I can't remember if it was myself or Representative Mariani who were chairing it, but or both of us at different times, but, you know, to pick at the lack of enough legislative involvement. And in fact, I did not even support Commissioner Segrin's race to the top application, even though I'd been there, because I didn't feel terribly heard in terms of my input, and I didn't like some parts of the application. So I wrote a letter of dissent to the president as that application was going forward, separate from the one from the teachers union, and they also opposed it, but I had other reasons as well. So I think it's always a tug and pull between the administration and the legislature, especially since they are full-time and we are not. But I think, and this we discussed a little bit on October 17th, was the fact that the real shame here is that Congress hasn't acted and gotten something to the president so that we aren't left with this waiver process. And, you know, that's to me is the problem with now having a less than perfect process, not that any process is perfect. But I think, and I encourage then anybody that gets a chance to talk to Chair Klein, who we have right here in our very own state, this could short-circuit this process that we have if Congress would just get busy and do their job. And that's my fear, that they will finally do their job after we really need this money and have worked on it in a really good way with what I think is a really good application, and then they'll pull the rug out from under us with something they have done very late and then ruined our attempts here. But I think we can't lose sight of the goal, which is our kids, and that we need some relief, and we all agree on that. I bet there isn't anybody around this table that doesn't agree that we need to go with a value-added or growth model for the measuring of students and how they're achieving. We acknowledge that some of the mandates, you know, forcing certain types of after school or tutoring activities aren't perfect. You know, I think we are doing the best we can, and I'm very sympathetic with having legislative involvement, but I just want to point out that we've reversed the parties here, we've reversed the players, and it's the same discussion, and so we'll all have to evaluate it as it goes along. But I think that the department is in doing the best they can with the inaction that we have from Congress, and so hopefully we can focus on the actual application more than the process here, because that's beyond state legislators to fix. That's a federal problem.
Commissioner, any response to Representative Downey or Representative Reiling's comments?
I'm just appreciative of having this time to have this hearing. I think that this engagement is really good. I appreciated everybody on October 17th as well, and just doing our best to make sure that we are engaging with you and our public to ensure that we don't have to replace something. We want to make sure that this is a better method for looking at assessing and holding our schools accountable that's meaningful for them and that will help them locally make the best decisions. So I thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Commissioner. And then just one quick question. When the waiver application is revealed, will there be an opportunity for public to offer thoughts on it, or is it going to be proposed and submitted simultaneously so that the input will be on the public side rather than on the pre-application side as opposed to having a submission to sort of tweak?
Mr. Chair, we have been, with the stakeholder group, putting things out to superintendents weekly. We have also been putting things out onto our website. And after Friday, we'll have a pretty good working draft that we plan on going out and talking with folks about. I'll be at the Rural Association tomorrow talking to them about waiver as well. And so we want to get this out. And then after we submit on November 14th, we plan on engaging with the public in town halls from now until there is potentially a yes. Again, this is being peer-reviewed, so we know that we will be getting feedback from the USDOE on our waiver to either tweak this or that or make this change or that. So we'll have to continue to engage with our stakeholder group on that. So we do absolutely want to get out there and make sure that people understand this and that they think it's a good idea.
And I'll make 2 points. One, I think it would be wise before the application is the waiver is formally submitted, probably a good idea just to get some public input,
sure,
whether it's positive or otherwise, to maybe include or exclude certain items. Then second of all, without seeing an application, I obviously can't comment on it, but I would find it would be challenging at best to submit a waiver that wouldn't require at least some sort of legislative authorization at the local level, and I would strongly suggest to the department that they consider that as part of their waiver guidelines. But Commissioner, we really appreciate you coming in and testifying. I know you have a very busy schedule, and we're very appreciative of you being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Deputy Commissioner Montano, to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Jesse Montano, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Education, and to my left is Sam Kramer, who is going to probably field a number of your very specific questions. My goal here today is to give you an overview of the process, a little bit of history. I apparently am the historian at the department. I've been there for a while, and I was involved with a number of you, Representative Greiling, staff, when we put our initial workbook into place and the development of that workbook, which was back in 2003. Commissioner Yecke, I believe, was commissioner then when we put together the workbook. Prior to that, though, we did establish a stakeholder committee, and that was under Ventura, and then as the administration changed, it was completed under then-Commissioner Yecke. But we did put a stakeholder group together. It had legislators, it had parents, it had teachers, principals, superintendents, business partnership, educational organizations, and we made sure we had representation across the board. And usually we had just as many observers as we had members of this committee attend every meeting. The meetings went through in detail every single one of the components that is currently in our accountability workbook that is in place right now that is approved by U.S. Office of Education. Our intent to submit this waiver is to change or to ask for a waiver or more flexibility on just a few of those. It's not the entire accountability workbook, and Sam will go into more detail on where they're offering us some flexibility. This is not the first time we've asked for a waiver in flexibility. Every opportunity that the U.S. Office of Education has offered or provided in terms of asking for flexibility, the state, Minnesota, has taken advantage of it. Just a couple of examples. When they indicated that we could do multi-year averaging of schools across 3 years, we took advantage of that, asked for that. We received it. We were able to take advantage of the flexibility to add a growth model. We currently do have two growth models in the state right now, the one that's mandated by the legislature. One is federal. Our intent here is to bring those two models, is to bring the federal closer to the state growth model. Another one of the abilities or opportunities that we capitalized on in terms of a waiver or flexibility is to look at including ELL and special ed students in the calculation of AYP that were exited out of the program and had been exited for 2 years. So we have taken advantage of all the opportunities that they have given us with respect to flexibility, and so we see this as a real opportunity to not identify 800 schools, but identify those schools that really are in need of improvement and to be able to capitalize and utilize a support system that would focus on those schools and not spread us so thinly that at some point you're not effective. We've used that same stakeholder model again. This time we have put together a group of individuals. There are a few from the previous stakeholder group. I think it's important to have that carryover for those who were through the process that we reviewed and used the input. You do have a charge, I believe a copy of the charge of that stakeholder, the stakeholder group. Know that this time as well as the last time, we took all the input very seriously that we received. I don't think there were any surprises. Representative Greiland, and I think you were part of that. I don't believe when all was said and done, there were big surprises. We discussed cell size, we discussed targets, we discussed everything. And so these members knew what the pros and cons were depending on what we decided. Our intent, again, is to follow that process. We will have a meeting this Friday, and we intend to go over all the various alternatives and options that we have discussed thus far from with this group around the four principles that Sam will discuss. Again, my intent was just to give you a brief little history and background of the process that we used for our current accountability model. And then the process that we've continued that process for this amendment or change to that workbook. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Sam.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Sam Kramer. I'm the federal liaison at the Minnesota Department of Education. What we'd like to do here is just kind of give a baseline as to where we are right now under the current system. This has really informed some of the discussion that we've had in the work group and in the department as we've discussed options related to this waiver opportunity. So the first thing to keep in mind is that under AYP, while AYP is reported for all schools, Title I and non-Title I, the consequences of not making AYP are exclusively for those schools that receive Title I funding. So statewide, we have just over 2,000 schools in the state, but we have 842 roughly schools in Title I status. Those are the schools that really have high stakes when it comes to their AYP determination. The AYP system is really a measurement based primarily on proficiency. It does look at participation on these state assessments. It looks at attendance and graduation rate. But if you look at what schools miss AYP for, 99 times out of 100, essentially, it's proficiency that they're missing AYP on. The proficiency targets are set with the goal mandated under the federal legislation of 100% proficiency by 2014, as Representative Downey referred to earlier. So essentially what we have done since the law was passed is that we've escalated our proficiency targets toward 100% in 2014. As you can imagine, and as you're probably well aware, at this point the targets are quite high. They're to a level now where many schools are finding it difficult to get to that level of proficiency. When AYP was released in September this year, we had 1,056 schools statewide not making AYP and 1,019 schools making AYP. This was the first time that the plurality of schools statewide did not make AYP. We fully expect that next year will be the first year that the majority of schools do not make AYP. And as you can imagine, with the 100% proficiency target looming in 2014, in the future, we're going to be looking at almost every Title I school not making AYP and almost every non-Title I school not making AYP. The consequences of this are that currently we have 340 districts not making AYP as well, compared to just 177 districts making AYP. And all this information is available in a handout I believe you all received. The consequences for Title I schools, as I said, are much higher, the stakes are higher for Title I schools when it comes to these AYP determinations. This year we have 368 Title I schools that are in some stage of AYP improvement. This essentially mandates that they set aside a percentage of their federal funding for interventions that have been mandated as sort of a one-size-fits-all for all schools around the state. This involves things like school choice, supplemental educational services, and professional development. Next year, we have as many as 442 schools, which again would be the majority of Title I schools, that would enter into stages. Our concern is that as we get closer to 100% and more schools, especially Title I schools, are not making AYP, there will be two problems that we'll face. The first is that we have a lack of resources statewide to ensure fidelity with the interventions that are being imposed. And second, and this is already happening, that there really is no meaning to not making AYP. If every school in the state is not making AYP, it's not really saying much to a teacher, to a student, to a parent, exactly what not making AYP means. So that is one concern, one of the major concerns we have going forward with the current system. The waiver opportunity, which has been announced in the last few months by the U.S. Department of Education, makes some changes to this that allow states and local districts to have more of a role in the decision-making process as to how they improve their schools, and at the state level, how we measure the schools for intervention. We have the opportunity to replace the 2014 goal of 100% proficiency. We have the opportunity to no longer identify districts for sanctions. We have the opportunity to remove mandatory sanctions based on AYP status. We have the opportunity to eliminate mandatory set-asides so that districts have greater flexibility with their federal funds. And we as a state have greater flexibility with federal funds, as do districts, and as far as transferring funds among different funding sources from the federal government. In order to get this flexibility, we must meet four principles which the commissioner outlined earlier, but I'll go over real quickly again. The first and really the foundational principle of all of this is that students are held to college and career-ready standards. To be very clear, nothing in the waiver changes the standards that we have in place in the state for what students are supposed to learn. Those standards have been mandated by the legislative action in the past, and we will. This year we've adopted an assessment that meets the 2007 math standards, and we are in the process of doing standard setting for reading in the next few years here, where we implement new college and career-ready reading standards. Second, we have to outline a state-developed differentiated recognition, accountability, and support system. Third, we have to support effective instruction and leadership. And essentially what they're asking for there is just what the legislature passed in the special session, which is a principal and teacher evaluation system. The principal and teacher evaluation system that was adopted legislatively in the last year fits very nicely within what they're asking for on the waiver request application. We're confident that what we have in place is sufficient to be given the waiver on that principle. And then finally, reducing duplication and unnecessary burden. Some districts will find an irony in this because many of the unnecessary burdens that they are given are from the federal legislation. And this is really an opportunity for us to get out of some of those burdens for districts, allow them to focus on educating students rather than submitting reports for the Federal Department of Education. As you can imagine, Principle 2, State-Developed Differentiated Recognition, Accountability, and Support System, is really where the rubber meets the road here. This is where we're looking at the most changes from what we're currently doing under the AYP system. As the commissioner outlined, we have to identify three categories of schools. Priority schools, which are defined as the lowest performing 5% of schools statewide. Focus schools, which are defined as schools with very low graduation rates, very low performing subgroups, and the widest within school achievement gaps. And then finally, reward schools, which are defined as those schools that are either having the highest levels of achievement or the highest levels of progress within a year. For these three categories of schools, priority and focus schools will be identified in list form on our application on November 14th. That will be the list of schools we have for 3 years as priority and focus schools. They will receive intensive support from the Department of Education and will have specified interventions put into place. For focus schools, they are really given a menu of options as to what they can do to address their particular situation in that school. Whereas priority schools are going to be implementing models for involving turnaround principles that really change the way that they're doing business within those schools. The list of reward schools is updated every year, so that each year we have an opportunity to recognize the schools that have done the finest work as far as achievement or progress over the course of the school year. In order to get to these lists, we have an opportunity to, rather than just focusing strictly on the AYP measurement, to use multiple measures to generate a list of schools that need interventions or that are deserving of praise. These measures that we are proposing include proficiency, because we do believe that the bedrock of all of this is that we want to get all of our students graduating from high school ready for college and career and proficient at the standards that the state has set. It also includes growth. So we're measuring students, the ability of schools to promote high levels of growth across all students. Deputy Commissioner Montano referred to the Minnesota growth model, which is in statute. That does differ quite considerably from the federal growth model that we use for AYP right now. Our opportunity here is to move our growth measurement for federal accountability purposes much closer to what we have for Minnesota growth. And we believe that's a preferable system because it allows us to measure growth for all students, not just those students who are hanging right around the proficiency line. We can look at students who are already quite high achieving and really reward schools for their performance and ability to move those students from just above proficient to exceeding proficient. Or to really, you know, the idea of, you know, they get credit for getting two-thirds of the questions right on the test. Our growth model could reward them for moving that student to getting all the questions right on the test. So that's one of the measures we're using. The third measure allows us to measure the reduction that schools are achieving in closing the achievement gap. Essentially, we're looking at how schools are doing at promoting high growth among groups of students that are in the lower achieving groups and how they're helping those students to catch up to their higher achieving peers. And finally, we look at graduation rate because as a state, we have always legislatively and as a state culturally said that having a high school diploma is an essential factor in a student's education. So those are the four measures that we're looking at. In helping those schools, we would eliminate the set-asides that right now requires schools to set aside funding for one-size-fits-all interventions and allow them to decide in conjunction with the department what makes the most sense for their district. For some schools outstate, supplemental educational services just have not been very effective because they don't have providers in their area who can come in and help the students. Similarly, in inner-city schools right now in our urban center, so many schools are not making AYP that school choice has ceased to really be a choice. If you look in the urban districts, there are so few schools that are making AYP that there aren't options for schools to for students to transfer to schools within the district. And then finally, it's important to keep in mind, we're still reporting adequate yearly progress under this system. The AYP measurement will remain an essential component of the accountability system. It's a good status measure to take the temperature of schools, see where they're at as far as proficiency is concerned. And that will still be reported. What will change is that we have an opportunity to reset the 2014 100% proficiency goal to reflect a more realistic and yet ambitious goal for the state. And in all of this, we're doing our very best to utilize the good tools that have been provided for us by the legislature and by educators around the state. We're not trying to reinvent the wheel here. We're trying to use the tools that we have at our disposal. Just to put a finer point on that, we are working, as has been referenced several times so far, with a work group And we have had meetings weekly since this opportunity became available. We've gotten some very, very helpful feedback from that work group, which consists of 25 members of the public who represent business, teachers, superintendents, institutes of higher education, charter schools, school boards, legislators, parents, minority groups, rural schools, Title I practitioners, assessment directors, special education, and principals. As you can tell from that list, it's fairly exhaustive. We feel like we've gotten really high caliber input from this group. On Friday, we're having our final meeting, and we're going to outline some of the proposals that we have taken from their input and give them an outline of what we're looking at for our actual waiver request and solicit final input and opinions on what we're talking about doing. The work group really has been an invaluable part of this process. We're working with the people who are dealing with this current No Child Left Behind system on the ground on a day-to-day basis and giving them an opportunity to shape what's going to be there in the future. With that, I think that we would conclude our testimony and certainly be willing to take any questions on the specifics of what we've discussed as far as the waiver request.
Thank you, Mr. Kramer. And very quickly, you said the three levels were priority, focused, and reward?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
And could you again just outline briefly for the members of the committee the criteria to assess the school grading system?
Certainly.
what the four criteria are that go into those the school
certainly grades. Mr. Chair, and I'll let the grading system that's for this committee to work on, I suppose. What we've talked about is a use of multiple measures, the four that I outlined: proficiency, growth, achievement gap closure, and graduation rate. Using those four measures, we are going to identify the bottom 5% of schools as priority schools. These are schools that have persistently had a problem getting to proficient and are also not promoting the type of growth that they need to have in order to get to proficient. The focus schools is a 10% of Title I schools, so you're looking at about 84 schools there in comparison to 42 with the priority schools. 84 schools that have low graduation rates, below 60% in most cases, schools that have very low performing individual subgroups, and schools that have wide achievement gaps within the school. That's the focus group. And then the reward schools are split into two categories. You have your high achieving, so those are schools that are showing really high levels of proficiency on the MCAs, the MTAS, and the modified test. And then the second group is the highest progress schools. These are schools that are getting really high levels of growth out of their student population. So those are the three groups that we'd be working with. It is really important to note, however, because this really only captures about 30% of Title I schools. That other 70% of schools is not ignored in this system in any way. We have an idea of kind of, we're going to continue to have schools that fail to make AYP for 2 years, as is written in state statute, right school improvement plans. What will change is that rather than having the Department of Education breathing down your neck and telling you what that school improvement plan looks like, the district and the school can work on that collaboratively at a local level. And with the other 70% of schools, for those that are low achieving on these multiple measures, there will be an opportunity for the department to get involved with their school improvement planning and possibly do some auditing to make sure that there's fidelity with those plans.
Mr. Kramer, you've used the term Title I school. Can you explain to the members of the committee what a Title I school is?
Sure, and I may look to Deputy Commissioner Montano for a little clarification on this, but essentially you're looking at schools that receive Title I funding, and I know we're going to talk a little bit about Title I funding. Staff here is planning on doing that, but essentially you're looking at schools that have a certain percentage of students who qualify for free and reduced price lunch, so students are in poverty conditions.
Ms. Montano, did you have anything to add to Mr. Kramer's testimony?
Mr. Chair, broadly speaking, I think he's nailed it. If you've got any specific details that you want, I'd be happy to supply them.
Any questions from members of the committee? Representative Downey, then Loon, then Senator Nelson. We don't let senators talk. What are you talking about? You're up. No, we'll come. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, a couple of questions for Mr. Kramer and then one for Ms. Montano. The turnaround principles in the interventions that are contemplated now, how different are they from both the nature and kind of the time frames of being implemented under the old NCLB provisions?
Mr. Kramer.
Representative Downey, Mr. Chair, it's a very good question. The turnaround principles borrow from the turnaround models that were mandated under the SIG program. The Office of Turnaround Schools is working with currently 19 schools statewide on these turnaround models. The main difference that you have between the turnaround principles and the turnaround models is the verbiage that's used in describing them. And essentially what you have under the turnaround models is things like you must, in some cases, fire the principal. You must fire and rehire staff. Under the turnaround principles, under the waiver, the wording is more the school should strongly consider replacing the principal or do a principal evaluation to find what's the best step forward in terms of school leadership. The school should look at extending school time, things like that. So it's more permissive language rather than prescriptive language. What we will be doing as a department with those priority schools that are implementing the turnaround principles is really work with them and hold them accountable to having a real effective system of turnaround ideas in place so that they are both planning and then monitoring their progress on turning the school around so that rather than showing really low levels of proficiency and growth within the three-year time period that they're identified as priority schools, they can show great gains and move out of that bottom 5%.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just an observation from your the semantics of your answer, it sounds like we're moving to maybe a process accountability as compared to an actual accomplishment accountability. And so maybe a second question, which I hoped you might comment on before, what's the time frame for that? In my mind, the NCLB restructuring timelines, frankly, were a little too loose. I mean, if we have a fundamentally failing school with a long track record of that and we give them another 5 years to keep failing those kids before they're shut down, that seems a little too loose to me. Are we going to be on those same kind of timelines, or are we thinking about something tighter if we've got this new process accountability thinking?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I would take issue with the categorization as process accountability. I know that can sound that way. What we have right now is a system where the federal government has mandated that within, if you're in stage 5 of AYP, you have to restructure. If you're in stage 3, you have to go into corrective action. The priority schools will have what is essentially an immediate restructuring, although it's not a restructuring as is currently defined. It's a restructuring that allows a school to reconstitute itself with a new vision and a new set of goals. These are in no way just we're not trying. I guess I would say we're not trying here is to let schools in that bottom 5% off. Quite the opposite. We're trying to give them the kind of intensive support that they need to make real genuine change within the school. I think if you asked the 19 schools that are implementing the SIG models right now, which is the closest thing we'll have to the priority schools in our current system, that there is a lot of change that takes place under those models, and it's not easy change, and it's change that some people get dragged kicking and screaming into, but has an opportunity to really change the culture in the school and help students learn in a better way.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, that's positive if we're going to be able to jump into those turnaround models instantly as compared to having to be constrained, frankly, maybe by the time frames prescribed by NCLB. Another question, if I could. Under principle number 2, the accountability and support systems, it's your kind of primary objective there is to have something that's ambitious and achievable. And I'm wondering what the definition of achievable is. If 75% of schools can make it, is it achievable, or how are you going to determine what's achievable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, that's a question that we've really posed to the work group and gotten some good feedback on. The federal government has given us 3 options for resetting annual measurable objectives. The first option is to start with your statewide averages as your first year goal for each subgroup. Right now, we have equal targets for all subgroups, all students across the state. With this option, what you do is you essentially cut the achievement gap in half within 6 years. So the goal is that if you start, for example, in one subgroup at a 50% goal, if the statewide average for American Indian students is 50%, just as an example, within 6 years, the goal is for them to be at 75%. Similarly, if the all students group statewide is at an 80% average, within 6 years, the goal is for them to be at a 90% average. So cutting that the 20% in half, or in the case of the American Indian students, the 50% in half. And the effect of that is that the gap between the lower performing subgroups and the higher performing subgroups is cut in half within 6 years. That's an option that the work group has been very supportive of, because it shines a light on the achievement gap, and it creates reasonable goals but still ambitious goals, and it holds schools accountable for promoting higher levels of growth among students who are farther behind. The second option that they provided us is simply to move the 100% proficiency target from 2014 to 2020. There's been less support for this idea in the work group. And finally, there's an option C, or third option, that allows the state to propose a method that is essentially a hybrid of those. We've had some pretty interesting feedback from the work group as to some ideas. Some have said that the goal should be that every subgroup gets to the level that the current top 10% in that subgroup is at within 6 years or 8 years. Some have said it should be 90% proficiency in 9 years. This is something we're still really wrestling with. There hasn't been a firm decision. I would say within the work group, and I certainly there are members here, so I don't want to speak for them, but the majority seems to have been supportive of option A, the cut the achievement gap within 6 years goal.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. One final question for Ms. Montaño. So was this work group in place before the August 16th waiver submittal?
Montaño.
Representative Downey, Mr. Chair, because we have not met, we have not had an opportunity to look at different changes. The concept was there. We changed a few of the members, but the work group was there when we did the 2003 version of the workbook. Some of these members remain, and so the work group met when needed, but then this was a good opportunity to look at some new membership.
Representative Downey?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Ms. Montaño, the commissioner submitted a NCLB waiver request back in August, if I remember right, and there were some broad outlines of that waiver request that I assume are still in play. And so question number one, I guess, is was the work group that's now working on the NCLB waiver for this November deadline working on the August submittal as well?
Representative Downey, Mr. Chair, no, but that waiver request was very limited. It did not go to this extreme, and so that was more of a limited, and I don't recall all the details. I think Mr. Kramer probably recalls more details, but it was very limited. It was not specific. It only asked that we're allowed to do some waivers very generically. It's not going into the specifics like this is, where we actually talk about what the targets are and so forth. Had it been yes, this work group would have then come back and worked on the specifics. That was very generic. It did not include the specificity that this is going to include.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Montaño. So is the existing work group free to kind of get outside the constraints of the August 16th departmental waiver request, or are you largely asking them to stay within the same broad constructs of what was the waiver submitted by the commissioner in August?
Representative Downey, Mr. Chair, definitely. This is going above and beyond what the August 16th request had.
Representative Downey.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Above and beyond, but...
broader, bigger. It's going outside the parameters of what that request included.
Okay.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question then. And I know is there not another deadline after November by which we could submit our waiver request, and what's the thinking of not waiting until then, if presumably that would allow a lot more public input and legislative deliberation as well?
Ms. Montaño.
Representative Downing, Mr. Chair, it was considered, but when you've got assessments that need to be taken into consideration and you've got very tight timelines and you've got 800 or how many other schools we've got right now, It just allows us more time to get things in place and to be able to have this ready to go by the next school year. If we had waited, the timelines would have been so tight, I'm not sure that we could do it.
Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think some of my questions were actually probably picked up or covered by Representative Downey, and I'll try not to be too repetitive. But
just partially repetitive, Representative Loon?
Expounding, Mr. Chairman, you know. Thank you both for your testimony. And in looking at the timelines and sort of the hard, you know, goals and structure that were in NCLB and making adequate yearly progress, I mean, obviously we're not going to get there by 2014, 100% proficiency. And I also, you know, disagree with sort of the hard top-down structure of that federal program on states and sort of removing some of their flexibility in dealing with helping all kids become proficient in it and having our schools do that. But at the same time, there's nothing like a deadline to make people work hard at achieving it. And so when you were talking about timelines and you said maybe moving out some of those goals a few years, and that was sounded like not necessarily a favorite recommendation or fell away, what are your thoughts, though, about setting some kind of benchmarks in there and timelines and structure? Because I am concerned about, again, I think as Representative Downey mentioned, you know, if we never have any teeth in this, I mean, how are we going to get to the point where we are getting all of our kids educated and proficient through high school and ready for college and career? You know, if nothing else, NCLB, I think, has put a bright light on a state like Minnesota that has always kind of thought, well, we've got a pretty good education system and our kids do pretty well. And that's not true. A lot of our kids don't do well at all. And we've been able to kind of sweep that under the rug and you know, ignore it, but for the fact that these very distressing statistics are out there year after year now. So how do we grapple with that? How do we do something and really make sure that we are holding our schools and our teachers and parents and administrators and everybody accountable for actually making progress?
Mr. Kramer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, that's really, I think, the fundamental question at the core of all of this, which is what kind of goals should we be setting for schools in order to get them to a place where we have all of our students graduating college and career ready? The current goal of 100% proficiency by 2014, I think, is among the education community and within our schools not a very credible goal and not one that they spend a lot of time working toward. I think having the opportunity to look at multiple measures like growth, like achievement gap closure and graduation, in addition to proficiency, gives schools more information that they can work with, more data that they can work with. They can look at how students are growing, not necessarily whether they're just proficient or not, but if they're on a track to be proficient within a few years and what practices they can use in order to promote more growth. As for the goals themselves, the proficiency goals, I think the idea behind the opportunity to reset the 2014 100% goal is to create a goal that is ambitious and achievable. I think that most would say if you look at the kind of targets that are generated from the option A, where you are closing the achievement gap within a six-year period, that is an ambitious goal. I mean, to get your students in the lower performing subgroups to a level of 75-80% proficiency within 6 years, while certainly not as desirable as having them to 100% proficiency in 6 years, is still ambitious and would be a great accomplishment for any school. So I think what we're trying to do is balance those goals with the information and the data that we're able to provide to schools to go that goes beyond proficiency, so they can use that data to get to the end goal, which is to get all students graduating college and career ready.
Thank you. Just two other quick things I wanted to touch on. One is sort of the notion of turnaround, and it seems to me you mentioned that one of the important things is the principal and teacher evaluation system is a component, and I strongly agree. But, you know, we know that some of these schools have been honestly failing for a long time, and in my mind, we need some turnaround specialists to be brought in. Do we know who these people are? Do we have resources to identify them? Are our teacher and administrator preparation programs turning out turnaround specialists? And I don't know if that's a proper term. That's the only one I can think of. To label what we need is for people to really come in and have the courage to make big changes and do it rapidly. And our systems are very resistant to that. I think most people would acknowledge.
Ms. Montano?
Representative, Mr. Chair, we've been at this for some time, and so the department does have a really good idea of what needs to be in place, and I think you've identified some of those. You need somebody that is with these schools on a regular, ongoing basis, and somebody that has the courage to tell it like it is. We have some models that we have developed, some processes, and we're looking at how we get these processes out regionally so that they are there on an ongoing basis. And then with a smaller number of schools, it's more doable than 400, 800, 600. We think we have a pretty good idea of what works and what doesn't work, and we know for a fact that you've got to have somebody there on an ongoing, regular basis to support them, to be there, to facilitate, to help them to see what has to change. Because you're right, most of the time we're accused of picking on them, and that they shouldn't be there. But when you've got these schools that consistently get identified, that you do need measures that are what I guess one could call tough love. It's not pleasant, but you do need somebody to go in there and really tell it like this, and I think we do have, we've been at it enough now to where we know what has to happen.
Representative
Lowe? One final comment, and I want to actually, I was reading the paper this morning, and I want to comment and commend my colleague, Representative Greiling, for her comments on early childhood. And I want to put a plug in and say that, you know, I think there's a couple of ways to look at this problem. One is kids within the system currently that are struggling and failing to make progress. The other is making sure that we've got a system to make sure that our kids are coming into kindergarten on par with their peers, prepared to learn and be successful. And if we did that well, we could probably have this problem addressed in 18 to 20 years. So I hope that is part of the discussions that happen in this work group as well.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, those are comments well taken, because that is something that we have discussed in the work group. Part of the problem for a lot of these schools isn't necessarily that the schools themselves are so terrible, it's that the kids are coming in really far behind. So one of the things that could be incorporated into these turnaround ideas is that a school, especially an elementary school that's in priority status, needs to at least look at the idea of implementing some kind of real pre-K programming for students coming in. And we're exploring those options.
Thank you.
Thank you. Exercising her alumni privileges, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Grockel.
Senator, can you pull the microphone over to you?
Thank you. I have a question about the four, I think, areas that you're looking at as far as identification, and that would be the proficiency growth, achievement gap, and graduation rate. And we talk a lot about schools, and we know that the real product is students and individual student learning. And my question, and really the one of the biggest problems or limitations with No Child Left Behind is the way that we measure. In fact, we're measuring cohort to cohort instead of individual students. And I know we have the technology now that maybe we didn't have 12, 14 years ago, where we can actually measure individual student growth. And my question would be, a twofold question. One, why is actually just measuring student growth not sufficient? Because that would in effect close the achievement gap if we're getting individual student growth. And then secondly, why do we need all four of those measures? And assuming there's a good reason for that, how are you going to weight these things? Because it seems to me that individual student growth is the driving factor.
Mr. Kramer?
Mr. Chair and Senator, those are very good questions, and questions that I wish you had been at our work group meeting in the last few weeks. That's exactly what we've been talking about. As for your first question, to why not just growth, there we do believe that a proficiency element is still necessary here for a couple of reasons. First, that if you're identifying schools based solely off of growth, there is a possibility that you're going to identify schools that already have nearly 90-95% proficiency, where it becomes harder to achieve high levels of growth at those high levels for students. So that's a practical consideration, but just from a philosophical consideration as well, measuring proficiency still keeps as a major goal that all students be proficient, and that we get students to a place where, like I've said a couple times here, when they graduate, they're college and career ready. As for the achievement gap measurement, there are two reasons for that. One's practical, again, and that's that the focus schools are required to be measured on their achievement gaps. The focus schools have to be schools with low-performing subgroups, but also wide gaps within the school. The achievement gap measurement allows us to capture those schools in our measurement. But also, as some have alluded to here, we are a state that has we do have a major achievement gap issue, and prioritizing that within a chart of measures that's used for accountability really puts more emphasis on that. And it uses our to be clear, our achievement gap measurement does utilize growth as the component that it looks at. So it measures the growth of poor performing subgroups versus their higher performing peers. So it's a hybrid really of gap measurement and a growth measurement. And finally, with graduation rate, that is really in place just to capture those schools that, despite maybe having some things going well with proficiency and growth with the students that are there, are losing so many students before they graduate. And as I said, it's consistently been a priority of the legislature and the state to promote high school graduation. So as for weighting, there have been a lot of different scenarios thrown around. I think that the work group has kind of given us a few different scenarios to work with. On Friday, what we're going to do is sort of lay those. We've done a preliminary step of doing this last week, but on Friday we're going to give them a real clear idea of what exactly we would be looking at under different weighting scenarios. One piece of feedback that we did get was that if there isn't a huge difference in the types of schools that are being identified in these groups, depending on the weighting, just weight them equally so that you don't have to confuse districts and schools with what it is that they're being judged on. But that's just one of several scenarios that we're working through.
And Mr. Kramer, when you're talking about graduation rates, is it on-time graduation rates or is it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's the new federally mandated four-year cohort rate. So yeah, the expectation is that a student that's a first-time ninth grader has 4 years to graduate with his class.
Senator Nelson, do you have a follow-up?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Montoya, you were talking about how the department's been doing this for a long time, so we kind of know what the solutions are, what the answers are. Can you tell me what, and I'm going to lead into the question of what interventions are going to work? I mean, we listed a few that we've got, that the feds mandate, and that we've got a few interventions that we want to do. So what are those interventions that work, that actually address the achievement gap, and what are we looking at in this plan to implement?
Ms. Montano.
Representative, Mr. Chair, there are a number of areas that we look in that we look at or that need to be reviewed in terms of when you go into these schools. It's not enough to go in and help them do a needs assessment, but you've got to have somebody there to support. So let me just give you some examples of what we find when we go in, and this is also backed up by research. One of the things that we want to look at is leadership. What kind of leadership is in that building? The turnaround models that have been used, basically as Mr. Kramer indicated, the ones that we're using right now for the SIG grants say, okay, replace the principal. But if you're working in a place like Panema up in Red Lake, replacing the principal is easier said than done. So why don't we go in there and look to see, does that principal really need to be replaced, or are there skills that we can provide that principal with that will allow them to be a good leader? One of the things that we find repeatedly, and we're surprised as we go in, we find their curriculum is not aligned to our standards. Well, if you are teaching a curriculum that isn't aligned to our standard, it's no surprise that your students don't do well on our assessments. The other thing that we look at is how often are you as a teacher assessing whether the lessons that you taught or the skills that you taught your students are learning, and by that it's ongoing on a daily basis. If teachers don't have those skills, don't have that support, then the goal is to provide those skills, to provide that support on a regular, ongoing basis. Through right now, I just left the department where we had a room with about 300, 400 teachers that are literacy leaders, and we're helping them to be better literacy coaches, better literacy leaders in terms of how do you work with ELL students, how do you work with your students that need differentiated instruction. They're hungry for good professional development, and I was just amazed and in awe when I walked in and found 300-400 teachers just sitting there, and we're providing a series of these not only here in Roseville but across the state, and we're also doing webinars on what is good instruction, how do you teach reading to a variety of students. So I think what this does is gives us an opportunity to really focus on those goals and not spread out so thinly, utilize those resources to identify people out in the regions, because you can't do it from Roseville. You really have to go, you have to be out there, you have to have somebody that's there regularly, on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, to support the teachers, the principal, make sure you've got good parent engagement. What's the culture of that school? If you, you know, I'm amazed at how you can walk into a building and within a day, you pretty much can tell, okay, I can see what's going on. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is, can you facilitate the process so they can see what's going on? It's not enough for you to go in and tell them. And that takes time.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a follow-up to that particular issue, I think you've defined the issue very succinctly and clearly. And it I guess tells me that we have two issues in those kinds of schools, the schools that are in need of turnaround. One is we got the wrong leader, which is kind of what AYP tried to address. Because if you're the principal in that school and you don't have curriculum that's aligned to the state, that's a leadership issue. And so I would absolutely agree with you. And I'm not sure that going into those kinds of schools and saying that these very blatant issues you didn't identify and so try to fix them would be the right answer. The second piece is that if our teachers don't know how to teach or how to address the teaching challenges that they face, then that leads us back into issues that we've discussed in the past in this committee with higher ed. And so how do our departments of education within our higher learning institutions teach our teachers to teach? And so those are two very big issues that that I'm hoping that some of the interventions as we continue to dig down really do address, and it's not just identifying what that issue is and walking away.
Mr. Chair, if I could just, I don't want to leave this committee thinking that every school that's an AYP has a bad principal. Sometimes it's also leadership higher up. Sometimes it's resources. So it isn't that every school has a bad principal. It's amazing how sometimes you find, whoops, maybe it's the superintendent. Does that school board really know what's going on? So it isn't just there. It's leadership in a broader context. And these teachers are hungry for the kind of support that is needed. If depending on where you're at, you may or may not have it. And just be, and I think higher ed is stepping up to the plate. But teachers need constant reinforcement, constant retraining. Our population has changed dramatically in the last 10 years, and so that support is needed on an ongoing basis.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Mr. Kramer. You'd mentioned that you know, one of the options that we had in AYP is school choice. So the ability for those kids to go to a charter school or a neighboring school. And then you made the comment that it's really not an option under inner city schools because there is, you know, there's nobody that's not performing in that. I'm looking forward to working with you on that because I have a bill that would help address that, which is an opportunity scholarship bill that expands the choice. I think we need to be careful as we look at these standards and these fixes that the feds had come up with, that we don't just throw them out because it didn't work for us in one particular way, that we need to be careful about some of these are good ideas, and I think that's what you're saying, and I appreciate you saying that you know, we want to give the schools flexibility to choose what's best for them. But I'm also concerned that, you know, we may just be replacing a federal mandate with a state mandate, because we've also made the comment that you know, local schools need to make the decision in conjunction with the Department of Education. So I want to be careful of that and interested in your thoughts on those two issues.
Ms. Montagno or Mr. Clark?
Mr. Chair, Representative
Kramer.
Yeah, the to your first question on school choice, I think what we've found under AYP school choice is a couple of things. First, that there are very few students who take advantage of it under the AYP system. Part of that is that we have open enrollment as a state, and parents already have some choices at a state level. So the federal choice aspect is not necessarily one that gets taken advantage of very often. Second, as more and more schools, as I said, in the inner city fail to make AYP and are no longer options for school choice under No Child Left Behind, there are fewer and fewer options for those students. And you have situations in Minneapolis and St. Paul, frankly, where if they were to transfer students under public school choice from No Child Left Behind, they would have such capacity issues at the one or two schools in each grade level that are making AYP that it would be totally unreasonable for the school to be expected to function normally. And then in the rural areas, what you find is many schools don't make AYP and get into stage one, where they have to offer school choice, but they only have one elementary school in the district, so it's not a very effective intervention for those schools. As for working with districts and the menu of options that they'll have available to them, I think we have in our school improvement team, someone has come up with a very good analogy for exactly how this works, and it's that with the priority school, in some ways the waiver requires us to force feed them. We need to put some change into place, and they're going to have to do that. The focus schools is really more of a menu of options. They have to choose from that menu, and they have to do some things to go in and really change the school, but it's based off of a local decision. It's based off of the school, the principal, the superintendent sitting down and saying, what's the best for this school given its situation? And then finally, we have these other schools that don't necessarily fall into the priority or focus category. What they're given is sort of an all-you-can-eat buffet. I mean, we're still offering a statewide system of support to these schools. We're going to still be reporting data that shows whether they're making AYP or not making AYP. We're interested in using this multiple measures chart that we're using to identify priority and focus schools to show, you know, how is your student growth, how is your achievement gap closure. And then those schools that are struggling on those measures, we will be asking to make plans, but giving them the authority locally to make the right decision for their district and their school. So I would say that depending on where you're at in the system, you have some real choices as a district. For some districts, it may be that school choice, offering school choice to students in a particular school is the right decision for them. It may be that offering supplemental educational services is the right system to put in place in that district. But we don't want, as a state or as a federal government, to be telling each school in each district, this is the intervention that you need to use because it will work in your school. Because in our experience, every school is different and has different needs based off of their particular situation.
One more question, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your indulgence. So when we look at some of the achievement gap, and you were talking about the different growth models we were going to look at for different areas, so African-American kids would grow at this rate, Hispanic kids at this rate, are we codifying our achievement gap, or are we kind of, by doing that, are we in danger of 5 years down the road of saying, well, everybody got a little bit better, but the gap is still there, which is a... you know, an argument of maybe why we're at our achievement gap levels today.
Mr. Chair, Representative Woodard, I think the plan, the idea behind having an achievement gap measurement as part of this system is that if you are not doing the job of closing that achievement gap, there will be consequences for it. You will be identified as a priority or a focus school, and you will need to put some interventions into place to address that achievement gap. And I think you may have been referring also to the AMO option of having different targets for AYP for different groups. The expectation, if we were to take that option, would be that the growth levels for the subgroups that are farther behind must be considerably faster in terms of the number of points they have to jump up each year in order for the school to make AYP. So. It is possible that fewer schools would get caught not making AYP the first year, but boy, in the second and third year, if they didn't show some real improvement, they're going to have a lot of trouble making AYP. And the initial targets would not be necessarily a codification of an expectation as much as a recognition of the current circumstances on the ground.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We'll go with Representative Dabney, then Anderson, and completion of those questions, we're going to move on to House staff for their presentation. So. Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, I was intrigued by your recent discussion on school choice as an option under AYP, and what you seem to be illustrating was where the real challenge is for school choice as a leverage for opportunity for kids. My kids go to an inner city school. The school scores at or above the state average on the MCAs. Now that's no promise that it isn't that it's making AYP. I'm reminded that I think Paul Simon had the song 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, and there's at least that many ways to not make AYP. But, you know, there's an example of a strongly performing school, so kids at other schools in the district would be able to open enroll there. As you indicated, that option is available to them, but few take it. It sounds like, though, from what you're saying, the real challenge on school choice as a strategy is in rural Minnesota, where with 70% of the districts not making AYP, where do I go? Can you speak to that, please?
Before you slip out the back, Jack, Mr. Kramer, can you answer that question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Davis.
That was nice.
You look confused by that statement. That's part of the song.
I think it may be an age problem, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Kramer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that is one of the real weaknesses in the system, is that it takes several years for a rural school to get to a point in AYP where there are any meaningful changes made in the school. If you're in stage one and you're out in rural Minnesota with one elementary school and that elementary school doesn't make AYP, there isn't a school choice in that district, so those students pretty much stay where they are. If you get to stage two and you're in supplemental educational services, they may be able to offer some form of tutoring. However, in outstate Minnesota, there are very few service providers. So what you have more often than not is some sort of distance learning or online learning, and there's just not much data to back up whether that's working well for students. So it really is 5 years of not making AYP, getting to stage three or stage four, where the school has to start making some real changes in the way that it operates. It's a real weakness in the current system that does not address rural schools in a meaningful way. We're hopeful that the system we're going to have under the waiver would, in fact, allow for more immediate changes to take place in those rural schools.
Representative Debney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Kramer. I'm hoping that as the department looks at models for dealing with the, I can't keep your language straight, priority and...
Focus schools.
Focus schools, thank you. That you look more broadly than the current proposals for turnaround schools under the Obama administration, because they've got a couple of things. It's always tempting for politicians and maybe bureaucrats to turn the apple cart upside down and then be able to go out and say, see, we did something. I think, as was illustrated in this morning's Star Tribune article by Dr. Paquel, that strategy hasn't worked very well in Minnesota the last 10 years. The apple cart has been turned over a number of times, and we're stuck in neutral if you look at the recent NAEP results. Chicago has some interesting approaches where they've incorporated outreach, strategic, thoughtful outreach to families as part of it, and some of their top performing high schools really do that well. Louisville has some seen some recent significant gains in some of their turnaround schools where they add to the existing models and look at things like collaboration. Collaborating with the teachers and the community isn't as much fun for politicians. It's a lot more fun to play whack-a-mole with the teaching staff and the administrative staff. It just doesn't seem to work. And I think the research on what happens with school restarts and the like often is that it's not a very satisfying outcome. So I hope that the department is looking broadly at what is working elsewhere in the country and not simply looking at kind of what's cheap, easy, and fun, but not productive. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I think what we're excited about is that there is flexibility within what is mandated for priority schools, where you can address an individual school based on their individual situation, unlike the four turnaround models that were mandated under the SIG program. So while some of the principles remain the same, there is flexibility to do what works best for that individual school. And what works in rural Minnesota is certainly not the same as what works in Minneapolis in some cases. And furthermore, I think we're also going to have the opportunity, because we have had 19 geographically diverse schools in the SIG program for the last few years, to borrow from the experience that our staff has had working with those schools as to see what has worked, what has not worked, what should be, what kind of efforts should be multiplied, which should be scaled back. And that's something that we're excited about being able to implement in these priority schools.
Representative Dabney, do you have a follow-up?
No, thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kramer, there's been discussion the last couple of years that if NCLB were ever reauthorized, there could be some changes made in the testing procedures that they required. Is your working group looking at that at all, either in terms of the number of tests our kids have to take or the amount of money we as a state spend on testing here?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, unfortunately, under the waiver, there isn't a whole lot of flexibility as to the testing regime that we have in place. We're certainly not talking about expanding the number of tests that are taken or the amount of money that's spent on those tests. There is an expectation in the waiver that the tests will be able to measure student growth. We're in a position to do that already, so we're pretty well set there. But nothing in the waiver request that we're discussing would have any impact on the testing system that we have in place right now.
Representative Anderson? Ms. Montano, does the implementation of the waiver have any financial costs at all that you would seek additional appropriations from the legislature on or need a different additional appropriations for?
Mr. Chair, because it's only Title I, affects Title I schools and the consequences, it's all Title I funding. However, if the legislature wants to give us additional funding to work with some of the non-Title I schools, we would be happy to take it, because as Representative Dabney said, it's not cheap, it's not easy, it's not fun, but when you see some of the results, it is very rewarding.
And in the event that the waiver is not accepted, does the department work on any contingency plans yet?
Mr. Chair, the department will continue to do what it is doing currently under the workbook, accountability workbook. It will just continue to do what we're doing now.
Okay. Thank you very much. At this point, thank you very much for your testimony and for taking the time to come down here. At this point, we'll go to Ms. Larson, Mr. Crow, and Mr. Strom for House Representatives' analysis of things. Ms. Larson, we'll begin with you, if that's okay.
Mr. Chairman, members, in your packet, there's a document that's titled Federal No Child Left Behind Act Accountability in Minnesota. And pages 1, 2, and 3 have largely been covered already today. On page 1, you can see the list of 5 goals that were included in the original plan that Minnesota, the Commissioner of Education, developed as a requirement for Title I. There's an explanation of AYP. As you see, there are 4 components, but Mr. Kramer noted that proficiency is really the key to this whole thing. On page 2, there is a further discussion about proficiency, and it shows you by percentages the number of kids in the past few school years who were proficient on either reading or math, and the number of kids tested who did not demonstrate proficiency. Also, there's a second table on page 2 that shows you the percent of students by ethnicity who passed either the MCA or grad and demonstrated proficiency. And if this is overlapped with the poverty indicator, you would find the lowest performing schools. Page 3 has a list of the sanctions that apply to Title I schools that fail to make adequate yearly progress over a consecutive number of years. And since all of that stuff has been covered, I thought I'd just spend a very few minutes talking about an idea that's implied on page 4. And as I was listening to the discussion, I thought it might be helpful just to remind the committee of the relationship between the federal accountability and the state accountability system. To kind of put it in rather simplistic terms, you might say that the effects of the waiver, if granted, are really 2 in number. One is that Minnesota would be given more flexibility with respect to the use of its Title I funds, and secondly, there would be fewer identified lowest performing schools. That would be the sum total, in very simplistic terms, of what the waiver would allow. what you need to realize is that Minnesota's current educational accountability system combines both federal and state measures in a single statewide system. When the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, ESEA, was reauthorized in 2001 as No Child Left Behind, there were a number of requirements. What happened was that the federal law requested that the Commissioner of Education come up with a state plan, which is exactly what she did. And my recollection of that whole process was that over the next number of years, when the commissioner approached the legislature and said the statutes need to be amended in a certain way to accommodate the substance of the plan or changes in the plan, the legislature did that. And so in some regards, in my opinion, we have a somewhat piecemeal approach to accountability because it's a conglomeration of both the changes required by the federal law and the legislature's reaction to some of the shortcomings of the federal law that have subsequently been put into state statute. So we have a federal accountability requirements in state statute. We have state graduation requirements that conform with the federal law, and then we have multiple accountability measures. Mr. Kramer was talking about multiple accountability measures to conform with the federal law, but we also have other multiple accountability measures that we put into the state statutes, and these include multiple course taking, for example, how many kids are taking rigorous courses, course completion, how many of those kids taking rigorous courses in fact complete them, and what amount of student engagement can be demonstrated. So you've got different measures of accountability, and also a further possible conflict is what is it that we're measuring? Are we measuring the performance of schools, or are we measuring the performance of students? And in that context, I think there are a number of questions you might want to think about. The No Child Left Behind statutes are really very broad in scope, but they are also very detailed in nature. The Department of Education at the federal level has been administering the federal law in a very active and some might say strict manner. Some people have charged that there is a lack of transparency in the way the federal government from time to time reviews the procedures and criteria attached to the law. And that begs the question, what is the net effect of the way that changes, waivers under No Child Left Behind, have on the system? It is a complicated accountability system. Have these waivers made the system even more complicated? And then another question, just in the context of where we find ourselves, having looked at the new NAEP results, having looked at our own AYP data, how timely are the changes that we are advocating at this time? You might ask yourself, are AYP requirements appropriately focused on improving education for disadvantaged students? What do we know about proficiency? It's a one-time measure. Are these other multiple measures more effective? Representative Anderson asked about tests. The tests that we've been using are summative tests. People say that if you want to improve teaching and learning, you need formative tests so that you can have ongoing information about the effect that instruction has and this place that people, students find themselves in terms of learning. Another question you might ask, thinking about the sanctions that result from No Child Left Behind, are these sanctions, even if they are effectively implemented, have they in fact improved achievement levels? Do we have the data to show that they do in fact improve achievement levels? And what about issues that people have raised in terms of international competition? What do these measures do in terms of international competition? And you as state legislators might ask yourself, what about the active role of the federal government? Is this something that you would like to see continued? So these are all questions that I would suggest might be in addition to the specifics of the waiver, which essentially are going to smooth out some of the rough edges of a law that is very complicated, has had some good results, but also has had some difficulties, at least judging by the legislature's effort to implement a state accountability system on top of the federal requirements.
Thanks, Ms. Larden. Mr. Strom.
Mr. Chair, members, there's a memo in your packet addressed to the chair that describes the Title I program. The chair had asked that I provide you a brief summary of that program. There's following that also several documents that I think will be of some help to you. The first of those oriented portrait style on the page is just the pages from the budget book. Every biennium, the executive branch's budget book has narrative describing programs. So this is a several-page description of the different federal programs under the No Child Left Behind program. Secondly, there's a series of printouts. There are two printouts related to federal funds that have relatively small type on them, but a lot of information on those. And the first of these is the national totals for the amounts spent on federal education programs. And the second of these is the same type of printout just for the state of Minnesota. And very briefly, if you look at the top of the nationals that's labeled grand totals, you can see that there's roughly about $14 billion of Title I money distributed to school districts. And when you look at the state printout, which on the third line says Minnesota on it, you can see that the for federal fiscal year 11, about $158 million, and an estimate of roughly the same amount of $161 million for the federal fiscal year that we just started. So those documents are a little background for you. And let me briefly describe the Title I program, and then we'll look at a state printout, district by district printout of the funding. Title I stems from the name of the Programs Act. Title I was an initial part of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which passed back in 1965. As with many federal programs, this is an act that's periodically reauthorized, which means that essentially it stays in place until the reauthorization happens, but it's designed to be renewed on a 5 or sometimes 8 year basis by Congress. I think with the SEA, it's generally been on a 5 year schedule. When it was reauthorized in 2001, even though it's still known as the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, it was given the common title of No Child Left Behind, or NCLB, and it's had that name since 2001. Title I is the biggest program for federal funding for K-12 education. Minnesota is not real reliant on federal funds for education purposes in our state. In normal years, outside of those with the stimulus money, generally speaking, about 6% of a school district's budget comes from the federal funds. And those funds are generally in three major areas. They're in Title I funding, special education funding, and the food service funding. In Minnesota, as I mentioned, we had roughly our state share was roughly about $158 million for federal fiscal year 11 of Title I money. Most of that, the vast majority of that, was in the direct payments of Title I money to school districts. Title I's a formula, not just a grant program, and as a result, there's a federal formula that determines how that money is distributed to each school within each school district generally. The federal terminology refers to school districts and charter schools essentially as local education agencies, and most of the distribution depends on the characteristics of those agencies, those LEAs, the school districts or charter schools, but some of the distribution also depends on the poverty standards at the individual school sites as well. There are four parts to Part A, Title I. Those include the basic grants, the concentration grants, a targeted grant program, which is similar in construction to the first two but has additional weightings, and then finally one that's more clearly a grant portion, which is the education finance incentive grants. The Title I formula has been around for a number of years. There's, with the reauthorization of the ESEA, No Child Left Behind, there's also a pretty big fight at the federal level about what to do about Title I money and how that should be changed, if at all. The formulas key off of state poverty factors. They take census data as the starting place in most states, but there are also a variety of built-in modifiers to the formulas. And some of those formulas are benefits to large urban districts. Some of those are benefits to very small states with low populations. And there's also a relationship in terms of how each state's share of the federal money is determined that's based on how much that state's K-12 programs spend. And all of these are somewhat controversial. There's more, I would say, in this round of reauthorization, to my way of looking at it, there's considerably more controversy than there has been in past years about whether these are the right factors and whether some of these factors should be changed or not. The Title I money is distributed to the school districts, the LEAs, and the school districts have some authority as to how they're going to spend that money. They have a fairly wide amount of discretion in terms of spending that money, but with NCLB, there are a number of carve-outs of their Title I money that limit what school districts can do with that. Most of you are probably familiar with certain teachers in schools or aides in schools being referred to as Title I. Often they're the reading or math special reading or special math instructors in those schools. But as I said, the programs can be broader than that, and with No Child Left Behind, there are also certain reserves that have to occur for things like the school choice and the student tutoring and that kind of thing. There's two different ways that a school can operate a Title I program. If the percentage of low-income students at that school is 40% or more, the school can have a school-wide program where the benefits of that program can be designed to help all of the students at that school site. If a school is below that 40% threshold, then the services must be targeted directly to those students who are failing or deemed most at risk of failing in that particular school. In addition to the requirements for public school students, the school districts are required to provide equitable services to eligible non-public students as well, using their Title I money. So in summary, Mr. Chair, I know you wanted to keep this brief. Title I is a large distribution of federal education money. In most states, it's the single largest chunk of federal education money. It's distributed to school districts on a federally determined formula. There are a number of twists as to how do those formulas get applied at the state level. The majority of the money for Title I in Minnesota is concentrated at the elementary level. There are some districts where Title I money goes to the secondary level as well, but the vast majority is the K-8 grades. And finally, Mr. Chair, I did include in the packet a printout for folks to see how those distributions vary by school district. And this is a printout the department kindly provided us. It says FFY, which stands for the Federal Fiscal Year 2010 allocations by district. And in the far right-hand column, you can see the adjusted award amounts, which essentially are they're very small adjustments for the fund balance purpose, but are the amounts of the awards to each of the school districts with the federal Title I money. And you can look through the list. This list was provided to us in a PDF form by school district order and see how the relative distributions of Title I money are across Minnesota school districts. And you can see that the vast majority of school districts are receiving some Title I money in Minnesota.
Wow, and Dr. Hennepin sure gets a lot, don't they? We haven't heard from Representative Dietrich yet, so I had to say something. Anything else, Mr. Strom?
Mr. Chair, no, I think that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much, and I appreciate the overview, specifically on the Title I stuff. Mr. Crow.
Mr. Chair.
You're good. Representative Dabney.
Quick question for Mr. Strom. I had not realized that public LEAs were responsible to provide services to private schools that would be, if I understand it, otherwise eligible for Title I. Let me find your thing here so I get it. In addition to the services provided to public school students, LEAs are required to provide equitable service to eligible private school students as well. My question is there any public accountability to the private schools that are receiving those services? Do we know whether those services provided to private school students are having any impact on those private school students?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, that's not an issue I'm familiar with. Ms. Montano, in a previous life, was the director of the division overseeing Title I, and I'm not sure if she's got some knowledge of that for us or not. Otherwise, I'd be happy to check with the department and get back to you about that.
And Mr. Strong, if you could, if you maybe forward the response to the rest of the committee, sure. That'd be great. Ms. Mon, did you want to testify? Did you want to come back from purgatory in your previous life, or would you rather move on to the next topic? Apparently, you would like to enter purgatory. Okay, Ms. Montano, welcome back to the committee.
Mr. Chair, do I have the choice?
Oh, when the chair's on your side, you do.
Okay,
Ms. Montano.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the accountability for the non-publics is not as strict or limit as we do for the public. Certainly, they're required to look at measures that they report to the district. And so the district really has the responsibility for the services that are provided to those schools, for the accountability measures that are used for those schools. We can't require them to take the MCAs, so they identify to the district whatever assessments they're going to be using to determine effectiveness. So they're held, their district is the one that they report to, and they're held accountable by the district.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Ms. Montano. It just seems like if we believe in transparency and accountability for the expenditure of public funds, that this is a blind spot that we've been having. We're subsidizing private schools and yet don't seem to have very transparent and accountable standards for the receipt of those subsidies. And perhaps that's something that the committee would like to look into further in the next legislative session.
Well, Representative Dabney, there was a bill actually last session that would have had some accountability metrics in place for private schools. It was Representative Woodard's opportunity scholarship bills. If they took the scholarships, they would have been required to take the MCAs, but the governor vetoed that.
Mr. Chair, if I remember correctly, first of all, it would have provided, it was kind of an anything goes standards of accountability, and in the end did not in fact require that the MCAs be part of the deal, because you could use according to the business partnership testimony last session, you could use whatever standards you wanted.
Representative Woodard, you're the author of the bill.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dabney, the final version of the bill required MCA testing.
Representative Dabney.
But it did, it was a anything goes on, you could use whatever standards you wanted.
Well,
Representative.
we were allowing multiple standards to be used with public funds.
Mr. Chair, no.
Representative Woodard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, it was an MCA requirement. It wasn't, I'm not sure what anything goes means from a from a standpoint of testing, but certainly MCAs were required of any private school that received those funds through the parents.
Representative Dabney, did you want to get a last shot in before we move on to the next topic?
Yeah, please.
Representative Dabney.
My recollection, though, is that they were not required to implement the state standards, that they could, that the recipient private schools could implement whatever standards they wanted. Anything goes.
Representative Woodard, you've gotten your rebuttal in. Representative Dabney's given his counter-rebuttal. I'm going to move on from here.
Fair enough. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You.
We can talk about that.
Representative Downey, is this a new topic, or you want to get into the opportunity scholarships fray as well?
Mr. Chair, this is a technical question for Mr. Strom.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the Title I funding, how much of that does Minnesota opt into, and therefore how much of that could we opt out of?
Mr. Strong.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, this is something I'm not aware of as well. I am not sure what steps the state would need to take in order to disqualify us from the Title I Part A grants. I don't know what thing we would have to do in order to be disqualified for that. When previous fiscal notes on repealing or on the state essentially declaring its independence from No Child Left Behind were made, the argument was made that the state would lose its Title I funding. I'm not sure of the specifics behind that argument in the fiscal note. And again, the department may want to comment on this. I'm not aware of any state having lost its Title I funds due to its recalcitrance towards NCLB. But again, the department may want to offer some advice here.
Ms. Montano, do you have any insight?
Mr. Chair, members. As Mr. Strom indicated, no state has opted out. The U.S. Department of Education has never really indicated whether it's only the Title I Part A money that we would be giving up, whether that includes Title II, Title III, and any other programs under ESEA, and whether it includes special ed, since special ed is one of the subgroups. They have never really clearly defined what you lose. For sure we would lose Title I Part A. Beyond that, I'm not sure, but since no state has opted out, beyond the funding that goes to districts, I don't know whether the other programs under ESEA would also be included, since many of them are tied directly to the formula and to Title I services.
Mr. Strom, did my understanding was the state did opt out, but I think your answer was regarding no states had sanctions imposed on them.
Representative Downey and Deputy Commissioner, my understanding was that the state that opted out, essentially the federal government said, oh, no, you didn't, or something similar to that, so that the state had taken an action and that the federal government sort of said, well, that action really wasn't opting out. So I think Ms. Montano is correct that I don't think the federal government views any state as having opted out of No Child Left Behind.
Okay. Any other questions from the committee? Representative Downey, do you have follow-up, or is that it?
Well, just maybe a thought, and I've asked this question in a number of settings, and that is, as compared to this new waiver, where we're kind of trying to get out of No Child Left Behind, but hang on to the funding, whether or not our state would be better off just opting out entirely of No Child Left Behind, living with the lack of funds attached to that, and then creating our own accountability structure here. I continually hear of the expense and the burden on local districts to comply with No Child Left Behind, and I was curious whether or not anybody has actually modeled kind of down to the district level or statewide whether we would be better off financially and in terms of state independence on accountability and testing whether we'd be better off getting out of No Child Left Behind. And I'm a little fearful that with this waiver, we're going to have a whole new set of strings attached to us, perhaps even for the long haul, that we don't fully understand by virtue of kind of cementing our relationship with the federal government on No Child Left Behind. And it's a bigger set of questions, which I think goes to my previous point, that we've got a huge issue we're dealing with here, largely through the executive branch, and not really getting a chance to fully vet our options and alternatives legislatively.
Thank you, Representative Downey. With no other comments, members, in your packets, you should have all your paperwork, particularly your blue sheets, if you can get those filled out. With that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.